There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Welcome back to the Women's Podcast. I'm Roisin Ingle, and today we are talking to Noelle McCarthy, a New Zealand-based Cork woman who has written a haunting memoir called Grand, Becoming My Mother's Daughter.
I have lived for most of my adult life about as far as you can physically and geographically get from where I started. And, you know, I took pride in the idea of myself as a self-made woman. And it was so humbling. Like, it was such a land to go home to Cork at the end of her life and hear from the people who knew her best what she had done to sort of set my course, that I never gave her, and I never gave her any credit for it.
We'll hear more from Noelle McCarthy in a moment, but I just wanted to bring you one woman-related story from the week. I was just really disappointed to hear the Taoiseach Leo Varadkar talk about abortion this week. We've had him on this podcast after repeal, talking about his advocacy and his change of heart around abortion. We've praised him for being such a strong supporter of women's reproductive rights, even if he had to come on a bit of a journey to that, which many people did. So his remarks in an interview he did with the Irish Times this week were disappointing. Like I said, Jennifer Bray wrote the report giving the comments that Varadkar has said he would like to see fewer abortions taking place in Ireland. Varadkar said that while abortion is sometimes necessary, it is, quotes, not a good thing. He was speaking about the Independent report, which has recommended a number of legislative changes, including an end to the mandatory 3-day wait to access termination medication. Leo Varadkar said, "I don't think anyone thinks that abortion is a good thing. It's sometimes necessary, but it's not a good thing. There are over 8,000 abortions happening in Ireland every year. I would like that number to be lower. Now, the way you do that is through much better sex education, the greater availability of contraception. That's why we're extending free contraception. You can also do it by making sure that emergency contraception is readily available. You need to do all those things, but I would like to see a greater exploration of that 3-day issue." He said, "Is it the case that hundreds of abortions are being avoided as a result of it, or is it the case that women would have gone ahead with it anyway? It hasn't been properly explored." Well, we actually do have some good information and useful information about that. Early this year, the Irish Family Planning Association released an analysis which showed that 447 clients who were eligible for early abortion care and for whom the outcome was known, 97.5% of those went on to get an abortion after the mandatory 3-day wait. So it's not exactly what he's talking about, it, but does tell his own story. And I just don't think it's helpful for someone who campaigns so brilliantly for abortion and the repeal of the 8th to now be looking at what is the right number of abortions. The right number of abortions, in my view, is the number of abortions that women need in all the different circumstances that abortions occur. And we should be focusing our energies on making sure there is wider access for those women, as we discussed on this podcast only a few weeks ago. Varadkar said he doesn't think anybody thinks abortion is a good thing, but that's not true. Abortion for me, in my situation, was a really good thing. Abortion is a fantastically freeing thing for so many women. It's a human right. It allows women to have autonomy over their bodies, over their destinies. Abortion is fantastic. Well, that's my opinion, and I don't think I'm the only person who thinks that. So I hope that maybe Leo Varadkar listens to the women and the men in those women's lives who know that for them, abortion was a good thing. I don't think it is just me, because Sinead Kennedy of Action for Choice has commented on his remarks, saying that the report compiled by Miss O'Shea was an independent report that centres on best medical practice, and it highlights barriers women are facing to access abortion services, including the 3-day wait period. She said, so in that context, I think when we think about some of the comments that have been made by politicians, I suppose most concerningly those of the Taoiseach Leo Varadkar, who talked about being both reluctant and uncomfortable to return to look at Ireland's abortion law, it's deeply troubling, she said, not least because this report was actually commissioned by his own government and it was him as Taoiseach who actually signed into legislation this law that requires the independent review. So essentially what he's arguing is that he's reluctant and uncomfortable about his own government's policy, which I think is a little worrying, particularly when he uses language like this kind of questions around the safeguards. And we've heard about many of the problems that things like the 3-day period have created for women and pregnant people who are trying to access services. And the other thing I would like to say about it all is that he's a doctor. Leo Varadkar is a medical professional, and I think he should know better. I was looking at the website of the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, where they're very clear about abortion, and they don't talk about the right number of abortions or whether abortion is good or bad. They talk about it purely in healthcare terms. And I'll just read a few paragraphs from their website where they say abortion is an essential component of women's healthcare. Like all medical matters, decisions regarding abortion should be made by patients in consultation with their healthcare providers and without undue interference by outside parties. Like all patients, women obtaining abortion are entitled to privacy, dignity, respect, and support. And it also goes on to say that where abortion is illegal or highly restricted, women resort to unsafe means to end unwanted pregnancies, including self-inflicted abdominal and bodily trauma, ingestion of dangerous chemicals, self-medication with a variety of drugs, and reliance on unqualified abortion providers. And this is a really important statistic that I think we need to keep in our minds all the time, considering we are lucky now in, not lucky, but it's only right and proper now that we have abortion access in Ireland. But around the world, around 21 million women use and obtain unsafe illegal abortion each year, and complications from these unsafe procedures account for approximately 13% of all maternal deaths. That's nearly 50,000 women dying from unsafe abortions every year. And this is the part from their website that stood out for me in relation to Varadkar's comments. Sound health policy is best based on scientific fact and evidence-based medicine. The best healthcare is provided free of political interference in the patient-physician relationship. Personal decision-making by women and their doctors should not be replaced by political ideology. So I'm hoping that perhaps Varadkar might rethink his comments. I'd like to think he would, considering he has in the past been such a champion for women's rights. Now, you all know I'm a bit of a softie, a weeper, and it doesn't take much to set me off. But I read the memoir of our guest today, and one passage set me off to the point where I was kind of incapacitated for a good 10 minutes. The memoir is called Grand, Becoming My Mother's Daughter, and it's by Noel McCarthy. I'll read you the blurb of the book. Quick-witted and charismatic and generous, angry, vicious and hurt, in pubs all over Cork City, Noel McCarthy's mother, Carol, rages against her life and everything she has lost. Soon after leaving college in the early years of the millennium, Noel flees. Even on the other side of the world, with fame and success within her grasp, Noel cannot escape an appetite for self-destruction. Life spirals out of control until she too is in danger of losing everything. At 30, she pulls back from the brink. Over a decade later, Carol is dying. Finally, it seems, mother and daughter will make peace, except Carol has no interest in admitting her own mortality. She will die as she lived, entirely on her own terms. If there is any reckoning to be done between past and present, Noelle will be doing it on her own. The book, as referenced there, begins on a visit home to Cork when she's waiting for her mother to die. Noelle has basically come back from New Zealand for a funeral, but her mother does not die, not then, and she's forced to return to New Zealand with her young daughter as COVID cases rose, eventually watching her mother's funeral on Zoom not long afterwards. While it is very much Noel McCarthy's memoir, it's also a massive story about her mother and about their complex relationship, which brings to mind all sorts of complex mother-daughter relationships. So I began by asking Noel to tell me a bit about her mother, Carol.
Sure. Thanks so much for having me on, Roisin. My mum, Carol, a force of nature is kind of a cliche, but, you know, that's how I think of her. When I was writing sort of an afterword or an author's note for the book, I was trying to sum her up. And I think in the end, I said she was like the weather. you know, because with the effortless ability to affect everything you do, your plans for the day, you can't argue with it. You can't, you know, but it's a waste of time being angry with it. It's a force of nature and it's primal and it's huge. And, you know, I think in that note, Mammy was the weather in our family, and she was, you know, she set the temperature and she set the conditions. And throughout my life, I think I had periods where I defined myself certainly in opposition to her. You know, she was a great antagonist for me, as I was, especially like in those teen years, and especially in my 20s, when I think in retrospect, I was going around the place looking for an antagonist. You know, I wanted someone to square off against. Our relationship became mellowed out as I became a mother myself, you know, more recently in my life. But certainly for a lot of our shared experience, we had a pretty volatile relationship. I mean, that's her in relation to me. Her personality was very magnetic. She was a very charismatic person in her own right. And she was also a very kind person and a very brave person. And those were two qualities I think I didn't give her much credit for until I came, you know, until I sat down and actually started writing a book that I thought was going to be about me, because I thought I was the most interesting person in my own life. But to my surprise, you know, the memoir that I was writing, as soon as I wrote, I think the first sentence about her, like the first paragraph about her, she was there, you know. And the first meeting I had with my editor, Claire, in New Zealand, the first bit of feedback she gave me was more of this, more of Caroline. You know, that's my mother's name. So she was definitely a powerful presence.
Tell me more detail about growing up in Cork with her, because there's, and I think it's not an unfamiliar thing for many people of a certain age listening, that you'd be dragged around pubs with parents. Like, we all have the kind of anecdote of having the red lemonade and the packet of crisps and being told to wait in the car or whatever it was. But yours was a little bit more extreme than that. I mean, some of your early memories of your mother would be, are to do with being in pubs and hanging around waiting for her to do her drinking.
Yeah. And again, you know, it was weird writing that stuff down at a distance of 30 or 40 years, because it really is like the past is another country. You know, I can't imagine that happening now. A lot of my mom's drinking and socializing was what I kind of see as stolen time, which is the time in between saying you were going into Dunn's for the messages and being picked up, as she was outside the funeral home at 4 o'clock, you know. And so my memories,
she worked there, didn't she?
She didn't work there. I had a cousin who worked there, but it was a very handy place to be picked up if you were from the north side of the city. You know, it's a landmark and everyone knew how to get there and how to drive off from it. But, you know, my memories are of being in those inner city pubs in Cork City, in the lounges. You know, it was always a lounge. You'd rarely get women in a bar. And in the lounges of the bar with my mother and her friends, and I certainly wouldn't have been the only child in there. I mean, looking back now, I don't know, again, is it just my memory? But it feels like a bit of a creche, you know, albeit like a creche with a load of cigarette smoke hanging in the air. And, you know, that those times were the times when she got to see her friends and they got to get together and have, you know, whatever the time was they were having. But they were always watching the clock as well, because, you know, they were always having to go back out into the day and do whatever they needed to do, you know, whether it was picking up other children who were coming out of school or, you know, getting collected. So I remember those times as being times when she was very intensely and vividly alive and happy with her friends, but always this underlying tension as well of, you know, the sort of sands in the hourglass running out when she'd have to go, you know, so the pints would be drunk quickly.
Yeah, I mean, you actually liken your mother to a werewolf in the book, that kind of transformation. Sort of, there's an excitement and a danger to her. She also loved in a quite a fierce way as well, I think, but then who would kind of turn into this monster with just one drop of drink. Tell us a bit about that, because that's, again, something you, that was your normal, I suppose, you know, trying to pour your mother's vodka down the sink and trying to, you know, make sense of it.
Yeah. And one of the things I was trying to do with this book was write the young me, the child perspective from a child's perspective. You know, I was trying really hard not to overlay the adult on top of it and to sort of be too rational about things. I was trying to channel what it was like as a child. And for me, you know, as a child, my mother's drinking was this massive force of chaos in my life, you know, and it really did feel as though it was one sip. You know, that was all it took. I think I'd talk about, you know, the scientist with the beaker in his hand, throwing it back. And then suddenly, you know, Dr. Jekyll is Mr. Hyde. And that's what it felt like, you know, for me as a child watching her. And then, of course, the irony was that as I grew up and my drinking progressed, it was like that for me too. And so when I sat down and was writing these times and these memories, it is images of transformation and kind of monstrousness that came to mind. I mean, she was obsessed with werewolves in a kind of a low-key sort of, she was very attracted to that idea of monstrousness as well, I think. You know, she was sort of fascinated by it, even as she was scared by it. So we had these things in common, you know. The Red Riding Hood story was one that she told me as a child. And then, of course, like, I went on and told it to my daughter without necessarily remembering the resonances, you know, with it, without thinking, oh God, you know, am I being my mother here? Which is, you know, my terror and maybe my destiny as well.
So there's kind of two sides to your mother in a way. There's that drinking side and that dysfunction, but she was also very, she advocated for you a lot, and she really wanted you to get an incredible education. So she sent you to St. Angela's, which was this quite posh school, and you're from the north side, quite a working class upbringing, but she wanted you to go to the posh school. So there was that, always that for her as well.
Yeah, there really was. And again, it was only in the writing of the book that I realized sort of, you know, what that cost her in terms of, she was a very shy person. You know, certainly when she wasn't drinking, she was very shy and she was very reserved. She'd had things happen in her life that I think wounded her and also meant that she was carrying around shame, feelings of shame, which made it hard for her to sort of come out of her shell sometimes. And when I think about, in order to get me into St. Angela's, which, you know, kind of unbeknown to me at the time, there were other girls from the north side going there. They were starting to go there, you know, like it was opening up and it was possible for a working class girl from the north side to go, you know, to a sort of a fancy convent school in the city. But at the time for me, it felt like a massive leap because it was so massive for her. And she had to go and sort of physically sit in front of the headmistress in order to secure a place for me there, which she did, you know. And people who know Cork will know St. Angela's is up the top of a very steep hill, which, you know, listening to her talking about it was like, you know, she'd summited Everest to get up there. But I think in lots of ways, psychologically, it was a big hurdle for her to get over, but she did it. You know, and she was very proud and happy, you know, to have done it.
Yeah, because, and also she kind of put a lot into parenting that you came to understand more when you were writing the book. Like, you heard stories about how much she used to sort of encourage your love of nature, and that she, you know, she introduced you to books and cultural stuff that she loved as well.
And so much of that, you know, was news to me, Roisin. Like, I don't know where I thought I got it from, you know, but I think I had blocked out a lot of that stuff, you know. I have lived for most of my adult life about as far as you can physically and geographically get from where I started. And you know, I took pride in the idea of myself as a self-made woman. And it was so humbling. Like, it was such a land to go home to Cork at the end of her life and hear from the people who knew her best what she had done to sort of set my course, that I never gave her any credit for it. You know, I think our relationship definitely got easier, and certainly writing the book, you know, gave me so much more insight than I would have had otherwise. But in lots of ways, like, and I don't want to be too maudlin saying this, but in lots of ways it was too late. You know, like, I wasn't able to sort of I wasn't able to give her that acknowledgement, but I think I was able to acknowledge her for other things, you know, other things she had given me and other ways in which she'd been, you know, she'd been an amazing mother. And that's kind of why I wrote the book in a way, because I was thinking all this stuff is super specific to me and my mother. But I was hoping there might be a universality to that, like, you know, that we blame our parents, like, for how we turn out, or we don't give them enough credit for the good, you know, for the good stuff that comes down to us from them.
Yeah. I suppose your relationship with her was probably maybe at its worst during your teenage years, would you say? And when you started drinking and that became a problem for you at the beginning in your teen years, tell us about that time.
Yeah, I mean, when I think about it, it's claustrophobia, you know, that I think about it. Like, I it's funny, I've just been home in Ireland and, you know, spent some time in the family home. And it's so funny to be back there, especially to be back there jet lagged, you know, like it's like a waking dream. That's also kind of a waking nightmare, you know, because these places have such power, like as psychogeographies. But yeah, all of this is a sort of long winded way of saying the house was too small for both of us, I think, you know, especially as I, because, you know, as I grew up and went to St. Angela's and grew in my own confidence, I knew everything. You know, I was a 15-year-old who knew absolutely everything and was, in my opinion, smarter than her and more experienced than her. And, you know, what could she tell me? And also, I think I was very embarrassed by her, you know, I was just really, really embarrassed by her behavior. You know, people who live with binge drinking or, you know, problem drinking might relate to this, because a lot of the time, you know, it's not being able to predict what's going to happen, you know, like it might be a fine, the day might be fine, but also it might not. And there's that sense, I think, of being on your nerves a lot of the time. So for me, I felt I was just very, very conscious of her all the time and very aware that things could turn at any point, you know, without any warning. And then, you know, the less said, the better about when I started drinking, because I was, you know, I'd come home on holiday, whether it was Christmas or, you know, for a bit of time in the summer. And then I was sort of her squared, you know, like the volatility just went through the roof and you didn't know what was going to happen. And you know, I talk about some of that in the book, but I certainly wasn't making the situation any better.
Talk about coming back to your house then now. I mean, you have siblings, obviously, and your father is a very, I find him quite a comforting presence in the book and somebody that I was glad you had, even though, again, you probably didn't see it at the time, but he was this kind of, I mean, he put up with a lot, but he also clearly loved your mother for all her complications and for everything that went on. But is who lives in the family house now? What's the story there?
He's there. It's his house, you know, he lives there. And my sister is actually there at the moment, you know, she's living there at the moment. And so when I came home with my daughter just recently, it was the four of us in there and, you know, assorted dogs and cats. You know, there's a lot of pet life going on there as well. So, you know, it was going back to that home without my mother in it. I was prepared for the strangeness and trying to be prepared for the grief of it as well. But I don't think anything does prepare you for that. You know, you have to kind of surf it, I think. And yeah, every day was different.
And you can't escape that claustrophobia in a way. It still lingers, I suppose, and the memories. And just going back to the interesting thing about you is even when you got, you know, dysfunctional with alcohol and all of that at school, you were a straight A student. You won a national prize for an essay, I think, when you're at college. You were brilliant. And on the one hand, you were also sort of falling apart as well. When you went to New Zealand, was it kind of, do you feel like it was an escape from everything? Is that what you were trying to do? I mean, you said it was the furthest place you could have gone.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I did feel, and like this may be just pure teenage hyperbole, but, you know, I absolutely felt like Cork isn't big enough for both of us with my mother, you know, and I could have just gone to Dublin, I suppose, or like London. But, you know, I went to New Zealand. That was where I ended up. And it did feel like an absolute clean slate in so many ways, you know, like it was very possible to invent myself there and to sort of, you know, chart my own course, which was why, again, it felt so ironic to be ending up, you know, at a sort of an alcoholic rock bottom there, because I felt like in one sense, like I'm so far away from where I started, but in another sense, I'm absolutely in the same place, you know, and that felt like a real cosmic irony.
Mm-hmm. I was intrigued to see that you kind of, the route to New Zealand was through Cafe Paradiso, which is one of my absolute favourite restaurants. And you worked there for the lovely woman who ran it with Dennis Cotter. Is that right? Was that?
Yeah. Bridget Healy used to be married to Dennis Cotter, and Bridget ran the front of house in Cafe Paradiso. And it was really Bridget who sent me to New Zealand. And again, you know, in the book, I talk about sort of the belated realisation that someone had been worried about me. You know, again, I think I just felt bulletproof at that point, but, you know, she had been. But she also, I think, intuited that I'd have a good time there. And, you know, my experience at Cafe Paradiso was like the only vegetarian restaurant, the only place that had like a sliding door that opened up in the middle of a Cork winter, you know, so people could get a bit of vitamin D and sunshine. And the walls were painted sky blue. And Bridget saying, New Zealand's like this, you know, just go. It's all like this. And she kind of wasn't wrong. You know, it was a very bright place, you know, like bright water, bright sky. And she sent me off. Right. She sent me off really. And you know, I went away full of confidence. I do. And I just thanked her the other night, actually, and the funny thing is, you know, she still lives in Ireland now and I live in New Zealand. So we sort of meet in Ireland and in New Zealand, you know, when we can in different parts of the world. It's great.
So when you went to New Zealand, you were first working for like in a fine dining restaurant, kind of quite a posh restaurant.
It was more buzzy. Okay. Like it was definitely fancy, but it was, you know, one of those restaurants, Roisin, where like all the sailors from the America's Cup came. Okay. And, you know, it definitely had a bit of a celebrity buzz to it in Auckland. So it was fast. It was more fast moving than anything and else, but it was great.
And it was one of your customers, I think, that sort of provided the link into media, into the radio. Is that right? Mm. Someone quite well known?
There was a couple of them. So one of the guys behind the bar, I had an idea in my head that I wanted to switch. I'd taken a year off an MPhil at UCC in the history department doing 19th century Gothic literature. And I thought, you know, maybe when I get back to Ireland, because I had a 1 year working holiday visa, and I thought maybe when I get back, I might do something slightly more employable and try and get into journalism. And that postgrad at DCU, I'd looked it up and it said you needed experience, some kind of experience to be considered for it. And one of the guys who was making coffees at the restaurant said you should go up to BFM, which was a student radio station in Auckland. And BFM was a sort of a disproportionately exciting and, you know, serious radio station, given that it was ostensibly run by students. You know, there was a lot of really talented people there, who many of whom went on into sort of grown-up broadcasting as well. And so I started up there, but at the same time, there was an Irishman who worked in television, who used to come into the restaurant, who brought me into the TV station just as a kind of an intern, you know, to see how that works. And New Zealand's very small in the way that I suppose lots of places are very small. You know, it was a relatively small industry. And I got a few lucky breaks, you know, between one person and another. And I got a chance to be the newsreader on BFM, which was a scream. You know, like it was just, we used to like get three papers in the morning and write news stories out of them, you know, like with pens and paper. And it sort of went from there. You know, I had the great good fortune to get a slot, the weekly slot, interviewing the Prime Minister. And it was Helen Clark at the time, because the Prime Minister in New Zealand, very, very smartly, very cannily, has always done student media, you know, and had a weekly phone in. So that was how I got into sort of political interviewing. And that was where I got my broadcasting training. And it was amazing training because it was live radio. You know, I did a little bit of television, but mostly radio, and it was fab. You know, and as soon as I did it, then I was hooked. You know, I loved it.
And you rose really quickly to kind of quite, you know, a serious position and everything, being in charge of people and being in charge of stuff. But meanwhile, while all this was happening, your drinking was getting out of control.
Yeah, it was. And, you know, it took a while. It took a while to really for the wheels to totally fall off. And part of that is because I think you do have stamina in your 20s. You know, like I was able to keep going and to be kind of functional. And I worked in a very, you know, I look back now and I see how permissive an environment that was. You know what I mean? We were doing breakfast radio and it was sort of, you know, it was par for the course to have a few nights where you might roll straight in the next day, you know, and start again. But eventually, you know, as especially as my work became more demanding, I think my anxiety increased. I couldn't do both. You know, I couldn't drink the way I had been drinking and continue to work, because also it was a demanding job, you know, and the drinking in order to sort of deal with anxiety, that doesn't work. You know, that's a disaster. So yeah, I mean, in a relatively short space of time, like I think by 2009, you know, I was in a situation where I knew, even if anyone else didn't know, that I was kind of running out of road for what I was doing. But at the same time, and you know, I was trying to convey this in the book because it's different now, you know, my life is different now and my perspective's different now. But I think, you know, when you get to a point where you need to stop drinking, when you love drinking, the idea of stopping drinking, it's just like someone saying, oh, go up and walk on the ceiling there, why don't you? You know, like, it's just like, you can't fight gravity. What? You know, this is insane. And so, and also, you know, I was in a situation where I didn't have a family. I wasn't in a significant relationship. You know, there was nobody telling me you need to stop drinking. I'd skate around on thin ice in work situations. But fundamentally, so long as I could show up and do the job, I was okay. But I knew, you know, I knew that things were getting unmanageable for me. And then, you know, that was the beginning of the end, really.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
And just bringing your mum, Carol, back into it, did you, when you were skating on thin ice and doing all these things, did you think about her? Did you think about the similarities, perhaps, and how, like, the book is called Becoming My Mother's Daughter. Were you kind of going, oh my God, this is my worst nightmare, I'm becoming my mother?
Do you know, I think I knew in the back of my head, like in that cupboard right up the back, like maybe, but I'd shoved it up there as well. I so didn't think I was like her, you know, like I thought, I've come to New Zealand, I got a career, I'm different, you know, I'm never going to be like her. So the denial was pretty strong. And also, it just seemed so, again, like ironic or ridiculous, because I felt like I had so much information about, you know, drinking and about how not to be. And And even though it was sitting there right under my nose, I really didn't feel like it had anything to do. I didn't think how she was had anything to do with me. Like, those realizations were very, very painful. And I just felt like a fool, you know? I just felt like, what? How, you know, how can this be? How can this be happening? Given the context is so different, you know? I'm thousands of miles away.
But it was happening. And then one morning you just decided that was enough. You'd had enough. It wasn't necessarily a hugely dramatic moment, which sometimes we think there have to be. It was quite a gentle moment. It wasn't even the worst night of your life drinking or anything. You'd had enough.
Totally. Like, it was quite a successful night, to be honest. I'd made it home, you know, like I'd made it home. I didn't have to make phone calls finding my handbag or whatever it was, you know. I'd gotten away with it. But I just think by that point, you know, I'd had a couple of half-hearted goes at moderating or at sort of changing things around a bit. But this was different because I was so tired, you know. I just thought, I can't keep doing this. I'm exhausted, you know. And it really felt like, it's very hard to explain, I think, because, you know, I don't like to think that I'm so confident now that, you know, that part of my life has been settled and I don't have to go back to it. You know, I feel like this is something that I live with on a daily basis. But I do remember that morning feeling like, I don't know where this is going to take me, but I can't go back. I can't drink. And what I did was, initially, I had small little goals. You know, I said, I'm not going to drink until the end of the week. I'm not going to drink until I move into the new house. You know, I had these little things where I never said, you know, it'll be for a year or even that it'll be for a month. It was very small to begin with.
And you also had a couple of things happen. You mentioned some photographs of you not in a good state had been published. And also you were plagiarizing stuff as part of your job. You were writing essays based off other people's work. You're very honest about that. So it was having effects in terms of your working life.
Yeah, it was. Absolutely. And, you know, with those things, I think, you know, it is a classic sort of alcoholic story that you can say, oh, well, those things didn't happen because I was drinking, but they always happened when I was drinking, you know. So there again, there was that voice in my head that kept saying, this isn't normal, you know, this isn't right. This isn't how normal people do it, you know, because I had lots of friends who partied and I was part of that group, you know, but things were happening in my life that had taken me so far away from where I, you know, where I wanted to be and who I wanted to be. And, you know, when it came time to write the book, I was very conscious that I still feel shame and I still feel guilt and I still feel pain about some of those things. But I also know that they don't define me. And I know that, you know, part of it is like, this is my story, you know, like, and I get to tell it, and it's hard to tell it in some parts. I mean, more than anything, it's that relationship with my mother that's hard to tell in some parts. But I also think, you know, my favorite thing in memoir is when people are honest and candid and give you the whole story, right? Because, you know, I did make a decision when I realized what I was writing, because that took a while to realize what it was, that I would be as honest as I could be, you know, that I'd just write it all out and not think about it being published and not think about anything that might happen further down the track, but just to be as honest as I could be. And I was happy with that, you know. It wasn't as hard as I thought it was going to be, actually. And it's more enjoyable than you think.
And when you came back then for the summers, that you came back to Ireland and you suddenly weren't drinking, because before you mentioned your kind of volatility and the fact that you'd almost be the two of you together and behaving in a similar way, and now you weren't drinking. How did that change the dynamic between you and your mother?
Well, I mean, it was kind of boring at the start, because we wouldn't have like the same dynamic. And, you know, I was as invested in that in my own way as she was. And what I realized early on was that so much of life And I'm not generalizing about all of Ireland, but maybe in my family or my context in Ireland, so much happened in the pub, you know, and it felt really lonely to not be part of that. Like I'd sort of, you know, say goodbye and sort of wave him off, or, you know, and there was a whole lot of stuff that was happening that I wasn't part of. And that was fine for a while. And I guess what happened then was, you know, as I went on and became more confident in myself and more confident in where I was at, it became easier to do other things. And also, but then I could go to the pub as well if I wanted to, you know, like my dad turned 60 and I came home to surprise him. And, you know, I have lots of photos from that night and it was fun, you know, like it was a fun, because I mean, it's just fun. Like it's a different kind of fun in Ireland and the crack is different, you know, and I don't feel like I miss out on that now just because I don't drink. But with my mother, I think the biggest shift was becoming a mother myself, you know, like our relationship was quite good. And then I had my daughter and it changed again, you know, suddenly I was not the focus of the relationship anymore. You know, I just became this bystander and the attention shifted. And when I started writing about my mother a few years back, that was the first, those were the first moments I actually wrote about because it was so, I felt it so strongly. You know, I felt the peace and the ease that came with not having to have that antagonism between us anymore, you know, and because I think she changed too. There was a softness to her and a kind of a, I think, you know, not to be too sort of heteronormative about it. Like I'm not saying every woman needs to have a baby so you get on better with your mother. But, you know, for us, it just took the tension out of things, you know, and my daughter was a baby and babies are so, you know, they're just pure potential. So I think everyone took a breath.
Yeah, and I think what emerges from in the book is this sort of getting to know each other better, I think, because you've had a daughter. So there's one time when she starts talking about your grandmothers and her mother particularly, and you find out things about, tell us about your two grandmothers, because I think there's a thread to them as well in this story.
There is. And part of writing this book, I guess, was I wanted to place myself in the context of generations of women. You know, it wasn't just me and my mother because we weren't formed out of thin air. And, you know, the truth is I don't know an awful lot about my maternal and my paternal grandmothers. You know, my dad's mum, Kitty, Catherine, she had 12 kids, you know, and was busy, like was just this incredibly busy woman and a really warm grandmother. You know, I just remember her house as being like the center of the world for her children and for grandchildren. And some of them lived down there. And, you know, she was absolutely that figure of, you know, of warmth and sort of motherliness. And she died, you know, she died tragically. She drowned herself when I was 14. And, you know, I talk about that in the book, how there weren't words for it. You know, there weren't words for the trauma of that, for my father, for, you know, I won't speak for the rest of her children because, you know, they're all still alive and, you know, that's their story. But certainly for us as a family, that was a powerful trauma, you know, that touched all of us. And really writing the book was the first time I've even thought about that. And what I'm amazed about is how much of it I've blocked out, you know, like how much of it I can't even remember. I had to sort of ask questions of people and look up things to even know the dates and the time of that. And then on my mother's side, her mother, who, again, I didn't know very well, except what I had been told was that she adored me, you know, and would babysit me. But she also adored the family dog. So she'd kind of babysit both of us at the same time. And we'd have to share the Maltesers. And it was really when I was at home with a newborn, you know, I had my daughter and my mother would ring and we'd sit there and we'd talk. And she'd tell me, she just told me things about her mother that made me think, oh my God, I think she had like really bad postnatal depression. You know, that's what it sounds like to me. And, you know, she was telling me these stories just about how she kind of, it sounded to me, hadn't been able to mother her, you know, like in as a newborn, you know, like she just hadn't been able to sort of do that to yeah. And my mother speaking about it was so understated. Like, she was so sort of, well, that's just how it was, you know, that's how it was then. And she didn't have any sort of malice or resentment about that. But it blew my mind, you know, like as a new mother myself, to think about that as being my mother's experience. And I was also thinking about, you know, the two children my mother had before she had me. And
well, tell us about because that. Because I knew because about, you describe yourself yeah. in the book as kind of the eldest of, depending on which version of your family history you want to talk about, the eldest of four or the middle of six. Because like you say, your mother had two children before and spoke to you only about it when she was very, very drunk. It seemed to come up.
Yeah. And it would come up in a very, you know, just a really traumatic and traumatizing kind of way. Like, there was just so much pain around their loss, but also it was a secret. You know, I was told it was a profound secret that we must never talk about, really. And that was when I was quite young. You know, we all knew about this from quite a young age. Well, certainly me and, you know, my two next in age siblings. And, you know, it was just that secret at the heart of the family, you know, that explained as I got older, I felt like this explains a lot about my mother, or this is a context in which it's important to understand her. But I didn't really feel it on any kind of level until, again, I had a baby myself. And there was something about how that affected my body, you know, like that experience of breastfeeding, that experience of postpartum sort of soreness, that for some reason I kept thinking about my mother, you know, I kept thinking about her experiencing these feelings, these pains. And, you know, one child was adopted and the other baby died. And I thought about that, you know, in relation to the physical experience of giving birth. And I became kind of obsessed about it, you know, like I couldn't stop thinking about it. And then while I was writing the book, I think in 2021, the report into the mother and baby homes came out in Ireland. And, you know, I was reading about this from a distance. And my mother wasn't in one of those homes, you know, thank God. But her experience of being, you know, as they call it, like an unmarried mother, had carried so much shame and so much stigma. And certainly with the second pregnancy, you know, she was in sort of in peril, you know, she nearly died. And reading those experiences, again, at a distance, you know, because I remember it was summer in New Zealand and I was sitting in a parked car in Wellington when the report was first released. I think there was, you know, the sort of excerpt they do at the beginning, and I read it. And I was just so powerfully triggered by that, you know, that it came into the book. You know, I think if my mother hadn't been in the book already, she was going to be in it at that point, you know, because it colored my experience of mothering and parenting and, you know, how I felt about being a mother and that sort of, you know, all of those feelings of physical and yeah, just that experience.
And there's one moment, I think, where she talks to you about, sort of out of the blue, as you're sitting with your own baby daughter, she talks to you about getting an epidural on her first pregnancy, her first baby, the one she had to give up for adoption. And it's kind of an incredible moment, really, where she seems to open up. Mm. And you can't even believe it, that words are coming out of her mouth in a way, because as you said, it's such a profound secret.
Yeah. And, you know, it was funny because we had a little baby between us. You know, like Eve, when my daughter was 10 weeks old, we brought her to Ireland, which in retrospect seems like madness. Do you know, I remember being ready to board the flight to Dubai and thinking, this is just insane. You know, we're going to be hurtling through the skies with this brand new child. And, you know, when we were in Ireland, we were staying close by near to the family home, but not in it. And I'd walk up early in the morning and it was on one of those early morning walks. You know, she was the only one awake and we had my daughter on the sofa between us, you know, like she was just sitting in between us. And I think I'd taken off her baby groke. She was a bit hot. And so she's, you know, kicking her little legs away. And she told me the story, you know, she said, because I think I was talking about my epidural, you know, like I also wanted her to know that I had sort of, you know, I'd organized my birth the way I wanted it. And, you know, I wanted a bit of I don't know what for that. You know, I wanted her to be proud of me. And then she told me her story. And it was, you know, we weren't looking at each other. We were sitting beside each other. So we were sort of sitting parallel. And again, she told it in a very simple, very almost casual way. And I just couldn't believe that we were talking about this, you know, that we were talking about this finally, and that the sky wasn't falling in, you know. And I also, for the first time, I guess, Roisin, you know, I felt heartbroken for her and angry, you know, really angry as well, because, you know, this is living memory, you know, like it's not a long time ago. And the way she was talking about it, you know, there was no dignity. There was no, it was pain, you know, it was a painful experience in every way.
And to have to give away that baby because of the times that we're in it. We're talking, I suppose, early 70s at that point. And it's interesting when her sister, yeah, her sister then tells you about the fact that after that baby was born and she had to give her up, and kind of there was no really more talking about it. Anyone else who got pregnant and they weren't married, they didn't give up their children. They saw what it had done to your mother. And the effect was that they kept hold of their babies, even if they weren't married. So it's that kind of fascinating difference between two Irelands in a way, you know.
Yes.
The change, yes, that happens.
And it's a hinge. Yeah, it's a hinge moment, isn't it? Because, again, like the 70s weren't the 60s. And the 80s were different again, you know, and in many ways, like my mother was like a modern Irish woman, you know, and I grew up in the Ireland of the 90s. You know, we had divorce coming in, you know, things were, I remember the Good Friday Agreement, you know, and I went to university, you know, there were so many things in my life that were different to her life. But I think, you know, she was part of that generation of women who experienced terrible things and, you know, and great shame and great shame.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that when we understand Carol in her totality and what she'd been through, I mean, losing one child who died, having to give up another one, then having to not speak about it and just hold all that inside, you kind of you see that she was in trauma. And, you know, the way perhaps she dealt with that was hiding away from people, sort of misanthropy that you describe, or your brother describes about her, and then the alcohol. But I want to bring you back to a moment in the book, which I thought was very interesting, because even though your relationships gets better, she's still a source of antagonism for you. And when you come back with your very young baby, you find that your mother's filled a room with this incredible array of toys, mostly for older children, and they're all from secondhand shops. Some of the toys are broken or just completely inappropriate, like there's a statue of a Native American holding a child. And you kind of get very angry with her. And the sort of echoes of that past frustrations with her as a mother. And you really do lose it, like, but it's sort of, to me, in that all that stuff that she accumulated for your, it was the only way she knows, or it's how she knew how to be a grandmother or to be something for Eve, your daughter. But it was really frustrating for you at the same time.
Oh, it was infuriating, you know, and it was just the fact that, like, obviously I'm coming from New Zealand. Obviously, I cannot take this stuff back. You know, I think I was flying Ryanair first before I was, you know, getting on the big plane. So I was like, I can't bring this stuff anywhere near a plane. There's, you know, 40 kgs of baggage here, because it was a lot of stuff. And I think what made me so furious is, like, as you say, she'd really tried, and there was so much of it, but it was so entirely kind of unsuitable for what I needed or what Eve needed, you know. And it felt like a metaphor in a way, you know, like for just not understanding. Because, you know, a lot of the, for me anyway, and I don't want to speak for like every immigrant, you know, every person who leaves Ireland. But, you know, what always used to do a number on me when I came back to Ireland was, as soon as I, you know, came through customs at Cork Airport, it was as though my life in New Zealand or anywhere else ceased to exist, you know, and I just had to come home and be the person and be my mother's daughter, you know, and that used to sort of drive me mad. And I think those presents kind of crystallized it. But I also think, like, you know, I've had people, When people talk to me about Grand in New Zealand, they never talk to me about my mother. They talk to me about their mothers. And I love that, like, or their fathers or their grandfathers or whoever, you know, like whoever it makes them think of. And I do think there's something in that moment about like parents trying to connect with us and trying to sort of give us what they have to give us or what they think they need to give us, and it not being what we need, you know, it being actually more baggage, you know. Also, I'm not very proud of that. Like, you know, I was really churlish and I did keep some of that stuff, and I kept the books, and, you know, I kept a few things, and they are precious because, you know, as soon as your parent dies, I think you keep everything, you know, because you're not getting anything else. But, you know, I think it is that frustration, you know, of the, I don't know what you'd call it, like things getting lost in translation.
Yeah, because you write very well about that. You say some women have mothers who come and stay with them after they have their babies, who clean the house and make dinner and do the washing, mothers to talk to about breastfeeding and nappy rash and reflux. I look down and see she's put two giant bars of Cadbury whole nut chocolate into the toy buggy, not just family size, even bigger. So it's that kind of...
She did. I don't even know where she found those.
And the kid is 9 weeks old.
9 weeks old, 10 weeks old, maybe.
Yeah.
I think I ate one of them. Definitely.
I'm glad.
Stressy things.
When you look back at that now, do you think with what had happened to her and because of her drinking or whatever, she wasn't able to see things the way, say, I'm putting it in inverted commas, a normal sort of grandmother or mother would have reacted? Like, what do you put it down to? Personality or all of the above? I mean, what's your understanding of it?
I'm going to say D, like all of the above, because I think she also had a particular personality, you know, regardless of trauma or like what happened to her. Like she was a particular person, a particular kind of person. She was never going to be a textbook mammy. Probably like I might not be either, you know, like she was always going to do things her way. And I accept that about her. And I guess one of the things I realized as well, again, belatedly, is like, just because people don't love us the way we think they should love us doesn't mean they don't love us. You know, like I do feel loved, and I do feel like, you know, I have a lot of relationships in my life where sometimes they don't look exactly how I think they should look, you know, but that doesn't mean there's not support there or love there. And I think a lot of the work in life is about kind of accepting people for who they are, and but also sort of advocating for what you want as well. And then sometimes if you're lucky, you might get a middle ground, you know, you might get something that is sustaining and good. But never looks like how you think it's going to look.
I mean, I've just talked about it earlier, that you came home when she was dying, essentially, and you were told it would be a few days. Mm. And then 10 days later, there she was, still alive. And it was a very difficult time because the COVID cases were rising. You left your daughter behind at this point. So you're in this horrible position where waiting for your mother to die on the one hand, but knowing you need to get back as well. And indeed, you did go back. But before you went, you have this amazing moment with your mother in her hospital bed. And I don't know, would you mind if I read a bit of it, or what would you feel about that?
Of course, yeah.
I mean, I should ask you to read it.
I'd be happy if you, yeah.
Have you read it yourself out loud anyway?
I've read it once, Roisin. I read it for the audiobook, and it was very hard, actually. And I managed to do it, you know, I did it, but I knew I probably couldn't do it again. You know, but I'm happy for you to read it, or to read whatever excerpt from it you want.
All right. Well, I'll have. Would you mind if I did? Because I think and I hope it would encourage people to read your memoir, because I think this gets to the nub of kind of, like you say, the universality of mother daughter relationships, which are so massive and so big and complex for many people, even though yours is your own specific story, but I think it touches on a lot of other people's as well. So this is a scene in the hospital. You're going to go home back to New Zealand. You're not going to see her again. This is the last time you're going to see her. And that's what this first piece begins with. This is the last time I will see my mother. I try to be very clear about this in my head so I won't forget anything. I can't believe I'm really going, but my ticket to the airport coach is on my phone downloaded. How can I go? She's still alive. It's not finished. I can't go, but I miss my daughter. I'm frightened of not being allowed back in with this virus spreading. I take her in my arms again, her little pink skull against my shoulder, her plush dressing gown in the ice cream colours, her face so changed and scary. The big black bruise blooms in the crook of her arm she puts around me. I reach both arms around her and they overlap behind her back. There's so little of her. I love you, I love you, I love you. My heart beats it out strong and true. And all those things I said and did, the times I threw her vodka down the sink and slapped her face and bit her and said, I hate you, they are all with us too. You came out of me, she used to scream. You came out of me, you did. As I tore the thin, freckled skin of her forearms, gouged out tracks in her with my nails when I was 12, 13, full of the strength of hating her. I would get down on my knees now and climb back up inside her. I am yours, the first one you kept, the one you had at Christmas. I am yours. You bless me each time I walk out of your hallway. I am yours. I love you. You are in me. You are inside me. I hit you. I beat you. I shook you. I am sorry. I love you, Mammy. I knew you. Anyway, I'm okay reading it now, Noelle, but when I read that the first time, I had to actually have a good cry for, I'd say, 10 minutes. And I don't know what it is about that particular moment, but it just got me. And I imagine it's something, it almost came out of you when you wrote it.
Mm. Oh, thank you for saying that. I'm sorry about the crying, but
no, it's good because obviously I was just thinking about myself, my own stuff. You know, it's like those brilliant pieces of writing that just seem to bring something from nowhere into your space, even though you're reading someone else's story. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. And I think that moment, you know, of saying goodbye to my mother was so surreal, you know, that I tried to remember everything as vividly as I could. And I also felt massively unprepared for it, you know, I guess that no rehearsal moment. And I didn't know how I'd do it, you know, and I was able to do it, you know, I was able to sort of come through it. And I do see that kind of like that morning, you know, that I knew I'd had my last drink, hopefully, as an operation of grace, you know, as something that was bigger than me. But also, I guess, when I was writing it, I was thinking about everyone. I was just thinking we all have a version of this, or we're going to have to, because we're all our parents' children, you know, and I don't know, everyone's version is different. And I felt very lucky, more than anything. I felt so lucky that I got to say goodbye, you know, and also that, you know, yeah, I did. And she was conscious and she remembered. And, you know, I feel very, very lucky about that, because like I said, I thought I was going home for a funeral.
I know. And there's just another little bit where you talk about this shortly afterwards. To my utter surprise, I know what to do now. I know what to say and what to do and how to let these last few moments play out between us. Everything is bigger than us and only us at the same time. And there's that feeling again of having been allowed for a moment to see into a powerful mystery. I love you. You are amazing. She doesn't say anything. I don't need her to. But it's that I'm so glad you had that grace moment where suddenly, despite all the complications and all the stuff and all the baggage, it felt very clear for you at the end there how to be with your mother.
Yeah, yeah, which was the hardest thing in my life. I never knew how to be with my mother. I never knew, you know, and it was always difficult. It was always hard. So the beautiful irony of that, like, was just, I was reeling from it, you know. And I remember I was going up on the train to Dublin and there was an Aldous Harding song that I was listening to on repeat, you know, and it was about, you know, it's the barrel and it's about, you know, the braid that you stay in as a child and a mother. And I just couldn't believe it. Like, sometimes the algorithm is spooky, like, it's terrifying. You know, and yes. I just sat in the back of the bus and cried, but I wasn't unhappy tears. I mean, that sounds weird, but you know, I felt very, very grateful as well as everything else.
Yeah, you were able to make peace with everything. It feels like, it does feel quite like so profound. You had to go back, and I don't know how long it was after that, Noelle, that your mother actually did die. How soon was it?
I think it was about a week. You know, and I felt terribly guilty about leaving as well. I mean, you touched on that, but, you know, it was my sister really who did all of the organisation and all of the stuff that comes with that. And I knew that I'd be leaving her to that, you know, like I knew that I had to go because I could see the cases were rising. And, you know, I knew New Zealand went into lockdown, I think 48 hours after my mother died. And so, you know, when I watched her funeral on Zoom, I think we were in lockdown by then, you know, like the whole world had changed by that point. It was just an extra layer of weirdness, you know, on top of everything else. It was like being in a dream.
And that's kind of where the book ends. But I mean, it's just, there's so much in it. I mean, it's like you say, it's your story, but it's also very much your mother's story. But I think it's the story of women in Ireland too, from those two Irelands we talked about and how far we've come, but also the kind of intergenerational stuff that can follow us and shape us so much through our lives. Mm. And how you've come to terms with that really and managed to beautifully articulate it. I think it's everyone should read it really.
Oh, thank you for saying that. And, you know, the thing I didn't put in the book, I said, you know, my mom never voted. But I remember, you know, and I know you've been so active, Roisin, around, you know, the repeal campaign for the Eighth Amendment. She did vote. She voted for that. Okay. And I remember her saying to me, you know, I was in New Zealand and she said, you know, I voted for you. And that was so, you know, oh my goodness, I couldn't believe it. Mm. But, you know, I was thinking of the generations of women who came before, but I was also trying to be really tight in the focus of just me and my mother, because that's the story I know. You know, I knew that if I could just sort of keep it on her, then I might find out something as well, you know, that I might sort of, you know. And that was the story I wanted to tell. I found it massively enjoyable to write about her, actually, like way more so than like, you might think, looking at the, you know, looking at the sort of, you know, summary of it on paper. It was actually massively enjoyable to write. It was great.
And I should say as well, it's very funny. I mean, that Cork sense of humour, and your mother was a very funny woman, like very smart and she hilarious as well. Like, you know, I think at one point somebody says, oh, look, you know, when on her deathbed and Noelle's come all the way from New Zealand and she goes, she didn't walk it. I'm just putting on your mother's accent. I'm sure she didn't speak like that, but that's my version of course.
She did. She actually did say it just like that, Roisin. And we were just talking about it the other day. I mean, she was just, she didn't miss a beat.
I know.
You know, when the doctor was asking her to go to the hospice and he was like, you know, please, please go to hospice. You know, it's so lovely, Carol. And she says, so why don't you go?
And this is, exactly.
Give
and
this a break.
I mean, and we didn't talk about her love of smoking, very committed smoker. And you're having your dance in France at your wedding to your lovely husband John, and it basically interrupts you so that John can go off and get her a pack of cigarettes, and like you're trying to say it's not really.
I thought it was a medical emergency. I was like, oh god, we're gonna have to get someone airlifted, and it was like she was out of fags. So
I mean, there's this,
I'll give him back to him.
I know there's this thing running through the book, like you're thinking all the time, god, she's so selfish. But in another way, it's just this kind of, again, her personality, just a very much like determined in whatever she wants to do. She's just going to do it, isn't she?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
But the other thing I want to say to you before you go is on the front of the book, there's this picture of you. But I thought it was your mother. I thought for ages, and until I've just done, I realise it's you on the cover, but you look so like her. It's actually incredible.
And it's an amazing, I mean, I love that ambiguity of that cover. And, you know, it was one of those little miracles. My sister found that photo. She was cleaning out my mother's house, you know, after she died. And she WhatsApped it to me in the middle of the night, because it's a Polaroid from a photo shoot that I'd done for a New Zealand magazine that I sent my mother. I sent it to her. They gave me one of the Polaroids. And I had no memory. I had no memory of the shoot and no memory of the Polaroid until Sarah sent it over. And I love it. I love it because I do look like her in the photo. And, you know, it's black and white and kind of impressionistic. But I also love that I had been keeping in touch, you know, like I had been sending her my clippings or whatever, because I wanted her to be impressed. You know, I wanted to show her that I was having a great life, and, you know, and I wanted her to have the the photo. So that was amazing. It was so good to have that returned.
Yeah. And what, just on before you go, what do your family think of the book? I mean, it's had a great reception in New Zealand, especially here as well. It's been acclaimed all over the place, which is must be wonderful and gratifying. But what do your family think of your book?
Oh, God. I think, my sister and my dad, I sent them the manuscript when I was writing it and said, you know, just after I'd finished the first draft. And I said, I'll change anything if you want me to change it, you know. And I was so buoyed up by their response, you know. They were so supportive, and they just, you know, my sister said, I can hear Mammy's voice. Aww. And that remains the single best review I've ever had. You know, it is just, I'm just, so grateful for that. And I guess, you know, for my wider family, I think it is a difficult thing in some ways because it's exposing. And I think, you know, it goes against the grain, certainly maybe across the generations, to talk about this stuff, you know. So I appreciate that that can be difficult, you know. And it's been interesting, you know, I've been so grateful and honoured to have the book come out in Ireland, you know, because that was always my hope for it. But at the same time, it brings it close to home, right? Like, you know, even, you know, talking about my school days, all of those things, you know, it has brought a sense of kind of exposure with it. But, you know, fundamentally, I think I've just been bowled over by the level of support and generosity. Like, I'd hate to be written about. I think, like, I would really struggle with it, Roisin. So, you know, my family have shown, again, like, terrific grace, I think.
What about your brothers?
Well, you know, I think that my siblings are all in different places about after my mother's death. I'm not sure they're ready to talk about it with me, you know, I don't know. And that's all right too. You know, I've been absolutely fine with that. You know, if they had wanted to read it, that would be fine. I don't know whether they have or not. So, you know, it's different for everyone. Mm.
And what's your next book going to be, Noelle?
Oh, yeah. Slow is what it's going to be. I'm writing about Dracula, you know, I'm writing about vampires, and I'm writing about sort of the vampire myth in relation to obsession and addiction and sex, because it's been in my head for 30 years, you know, and it finally feels like time to get it out. And it's nonfiction, you know, it's another kind of memoir, but with a bit more maybe literary sort of a look at that novel and how it came to be and why, you know, just thinking about why it's been so powerful and such a part of the culture over the last 120 years. So it's quite fun.
Well, and also by an Irishman as well. So that gives you a good link.
A Dublin man.
Yeah. Only down the road from
by
here.
By Sligo.
Clontarf.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, amazing. Yeah. I was there the other day. I went to Dublin Castle to his old workplace and
sort of
did the tourist thing.
Fascinating,
you know,
man,
touched
really.
The stones.
Yeah.
Amazing,
and
man.
I love reading Joe O'Connor's book about him in London.
Shadow Play,
yeah,
yes.
So
it was
good.
It was wonderful. Such a beautiful novel.
Well, listen, I hope you're not going to fall out with any of your family because of this book, because it's too good a thing for anyone to fall out with. But I think it is difficult getting so close to the bone with family stuff. And hopefully any tension will ease as time goes on, if there is any. But it's just...
You just hope, yeah.
Yeah, it's such an incredible book. I'll be recommending it to everyone. I'm going to recommend it as one of my summer reads in our new book club, because even though it is, there's a lot of dark stuff in it, it's very funny, it's written exquisitely, and there's a lot of that humor there as well. And thank you so much, Roisin. You're very welcome.
It's
thanks for
pleasure.
Coming on to talk to us about it.
Thank you so much, and thanks for putting up with my dodgy Wi-Fi from Spain.
No problem. All right, all the best. Thank you.
Bye.
That was Noelle McCarthy there, and her book is called Grand, Becoming My Mother's Daughter. The podcast is produced by Suzanne Brennan and me, Roisin Ingle, with JJ Vernon on sound. Get in touch with us on social at IT Women's Podcast, or by email thewomenspodcast@irishtimes.com. We love hearing from you. Mind yourselves, and I'll talk to you next time.
Ever Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.